You are listening to a podcast from The National.
Hi, welcome to Extra Time, the National's football podcast. I'm your host, John Turner. Joining me in the studio this week is sports reporter John McCauley. John, how are you doing, mate?
Hey, Johnny. Very well, thanks.
Good stuff. And deputy sports editor, Steve Luckings. Steve, how are you?
No, I'm fuming, mate. Absolutely fuming.
Why is that? It's only the start of the week.
Well, I took a four-point hit to get Sadio Mane in my team, and he goes and lets me down, doesn't he?
We'll discuss that a bit later on, shall we, mate? There's never a dull day in the Premier League, and so it's proved on the very first day of this week when it was announced that Frank de Boer has been sacked as Crystal Palace manager after just four league games in charge. We'll also discuss the big talking points from this past weekend, including Manchester City's five-star showing against Liverpool, Harry Kane getting off the mark, and Renato Sanchez's Swansea debut. We'll then look ahead to Tuesday and Wednesday night as the UEFA Champions League group stage kicks off. Joining us on the phone to discuss Frank de Boer's departure is Richard Jolly. Richard, after just 77 days in charge, four Premier League games that is, four defeats, no goals, de Boer has been sacked by Crystal Palace. Given the noise before the Burnley game, the news isn't in some ways entirely surprising, yet when a manager's been fired after four games, it is. What's your kind of initial reactions to all of this?
Yeah, I think you've summed it up very well, because Frank de Boer has had the shortest reign in terms of league games of any Premier League manager ever. So that clearly is a shock. And when he was appointed in the summer, it was presented as a long-term appointment. He never seemed one of the kind of caretaker managers that you bring in to tie yourself over for a few months. But with all the rumblings that have been coming out of Palace in the last couple of weeks, really, it's no shock whatsoever. I think anyone who read Steve Parrish's tweets on Sunday evening could see the pressure that Steve Parrish was under. I think if you look at it statistically, the fact that no other team for 93 years in the English top flight has lost their first four games without scoring is pretty damning. You then look at who those defeats were against. Now, one of them was Liverpool, and Palace didn't play that badly that day. But the other three were against Huddersfield, Swansea and Burnley, three of the teams that a lot of people tipped to be in the relegation battle. And then also, if you look at the fixture list, you see that Crystal Palace have got Southampton next, and then they've got Chelsea and the Manchester clubs. So there's the real possibility that after eight games, they could still be on no goals and no points. And with a squad that I think should probably be about 11th or 12th in the league, they could be facing a real, real uphill task. As it is, they're probably still going to be in the relegation zone for quite a while, but they at least need to show signs that they've turned the corner and they're getting back on track, because the de Boer reign has been confusing in a lot of ways. He's obviously tried to change too much too quickly. I think he was the wrong man to begin with, a real stylistic clash between his ideas and the methods that have worked well for Palace in recent years under managers such as Sam Allardyce. I don't know why in the summer he imposed that 3-4-3 formation on Palace when it just didn't seem to suit them at all. He reverted to their favoured 4-3-3 at Burnley on Sunday, and I think everyone from his own players to the Burnley manager Sean Dyche said that Palace looks much more like themselves, much more like the side that can get results and a side that was playing towards their strengths. But I think one of the most damning things is how quickly Palace, from thinking they were going into this brave new world, have concluded they were completely and utterly wrong and are reverting to a very, very different type of manager, it would appear, in Roy Hodgson, someone of a different generation, a different nationality, a different style of play. And thus, this experiment has been ripped up after just four games.
And what are your thoughts on that, Richard? With Roy Hodgson looking like the likely, or at least the leading contender at the moment, according to widespread reports, what's your initial reaction to that? Do you think that's Palace are now looking for a kind of safer pair of hands? Is it the right direction they should be going in, at least in the short term? What are your initial thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think a safer pair of hands is very much an accurate description. I think the ideal manager for them, given that the position they're in, is the one they just had, Sam Allardyce. But he's clearly not willing to step back in just yet. And Palace have basically, in recent years, Palace have tended to get themselves out of relegation trouble by sacking managers in mid-season and bringing in experienced British managers who don't try and play hugely ambitious, hugely exciting football, but are quite pragmatic and play the percentages. It worked very well with Allardyce. It worked very well with Tony Pulis. It worked well initially with Alan Pardew. The problem with him was more when he tried to then switch to a more expansive game plan. Hodgson, despite what happened to him with both England and Liverpool, I think is a manager who is better suited to working in environments with lesser players and lesser expectations. And thus, that could quite suit Crystal Palace. I think he probably needs to come in and get some clean sheets, which De Boer obviously hasn't had, get Christian Benteke scoring. As I say, I still think that squad is about the 11th or 12th best in the division. So Palace, under Hodgson, I would expect to stay up.
Richard, you mentioned earlier about Palace looking for signs of life. I mean, you were at Turf Moor yesterday, where it was a 1-0 win for Burnley, but it could have really been a lot more for Palace in terms of chances created. Scott Dan, of course, had that glaring chance that he missed right at the death. Surely, from what was on show yesterday and from what you could see inside the stadium, that was some significant improvement from Palace. Do you think, just on the back of what happened at Turf Moor yesterday, that De Boer can count himself a little bit unlucky, even if the kind of problems run a bit deeper? If it was based on signs of life and signs of improvement, that was certainly shown yesterday.
I mean, it was improvement, but it was improvement from a very, very low base. They've not been too bad in the two away games at Liverpool and at Burnley, but they've been absolutely diabolical in the two home games against Huddersfield and Swansea. And you can look at the chances and the fact that Scott Dan could have had a hat-trick. But I think some of the descriptions of Palace's performances at Burnley have been a bit exaggerated. I didn't think it was a particularly good performance. I thought there were large swathes of the game where they just indulged in pointless sideways passing and got absolutely nowhere. I thought they really missed a trick when Tom Heaton went off injured and Burnley had to bring on Nick Pope, an untried goalkeeper for his Premier League debut. And Palace barely tested him for about 40 minutes. And if you look at the sort of the 60-odd minutes that Pope was actually on the pitch, he only actually had one good save to make, which was the save from Christian Benteke. Now, there was a goal line clearance and a miss from Dan in that time as well. But I don't think it's quite the sort of bombardment that has been portrayed in some places. But on the other hand, in other respects, De Boer clearly is luckless. Wilfried Zaha, Palace's player of the year last year, has barely played for him. Mamadou Sakho was signed right at the end of the transfer window, wasn't deemed ready to make his debut at Burnley and thus didn't play for him at all. Ruben Loftus-Cheeks missed the last two games when he looked to be one of the few players who might have been responding quite well to De Boer's management. And then if you look at the manner of the goal conceded at Burnley, it was a complete free goal, but it was the sort that tends to happen when everything's going wrong. But as to whether that was really a sign that Palace were on an upward curve, I mean, I wasn't convinced. I thought De Boer's rhetoric after the game was strangely upbeat. Maybe it was an attempt to win over the board. If so, it failed. But I wasn't particularly impressed by Palace. I didn't think Burnley played well. Speaking to people who watch Burnley, that was Burnley's worst performance of the season, and they still got all 3 points.
Of course, it's still very early days in the Premier League, Richard. That's why this news is so surprising. Do you expect Palace to regroup now and at least to the extent where they can, you know, secure Premier League survival come May?
Yeah, I think they probably will stay up. One of my theories is that if Christian Benteke stays fit for a season, he keeps the team up. If you look at Palace last year, he got 15 league goals. They stayed up. If you look at his 3 seasons at Aston Villa, he averaged 14 league goals over that time. They stayed up every season. They went down the first season after Benteke left. I think there are considerably weaker squads than Palace. But what would worry me if I were a Palace fan is to look at the damage that has been done already and which will probably be increased by the time they get to the end of these first 8 games and those meetings with Chelsea and the Manchester clubs. Because if you'd gone back to the start of the season, most people would have been predicting Palace to take more points than Burnley, for instance, more points than Huddersfield, more points than Newcastle. Well, as it stands, they've got to, if they want to finish ahead of Burnley, they've got a 7-point deficit already. They've got a 6-point deficit to Newcastle. They've got a 7-point deficit to Huddersfield, and we're speaking before Huddersfield play West Ham, so that could even be increased. They've got to catch at least three clubs, and that's not going to be easy if after 8 games they find themselves 10 points behind Burnley and Huddersfield and Newcastle and potentially Swansea or Brighton or someone else. So, yes, I think Palace, there is enough there for them to get 38 points from their last 30 games or so, but they've also got to catch three other clubs, if not more.
Richard, thank you very much for your time this week. Much appreciated, as always.
No problem.
Thanks a lot. We'll get back to football in just a second, but first we'd like to tell you about the other podcast from The National. Beyond the Headlines takes a deeper dive into the biggest news from the week with a distinct Middle Eastern point of view. And Business Extra is the best source to learn more about the figures who make the region such an important hub in the world. Subscribe to both shows as well as Extra Time on iTunes. And as always, we're online at thenational.ae. Let's go back to the start of this weekend, gentlemen. Manchester City, Liverpool, big blockbuster game this weekend. Everyone was expecting plenty of goals. They only ever went in one way, though, didn't they? 5-0 to Manchester City. Plenty to talk about there. Sadio Mane's red card was a big talking point. I wouldn't say it's contentious by any means, but what did you make of the game? What did you kind of think of everything? Steve, let's start with you.
Well, first of all, let's address the major talking point, which was Mane sending off. Now, to listen to some Liverpool fans try and defend him, even the player and manager himself saying it was an accident. Well, of course it was an accident. He didn't go in to leave a bit on Edison. But, I mean, it's not even up for debate. That's a straight red. And even take out the fact that it was head high. If he hits a goalkeeper coming out of his area on the belly, on the knee, anything above ball height, that's a red card. If he did that to a defender, both going through the ball, it would be a straight red card. Like, there's absolutely no debate about it whatsoever.
Yeah, I don't think people were saying it wasn't intentional, but I think intent is redundant there. I don't think it's dangerous playing.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, he had to go because Ederson ended up on the ground for 8 minutes and ended up with cuts on his faces and came back with bandages and things like that. So, you know, it was a pretty serious incident. And Manny had his eyes on the ball. I totally understand that, but he took the goalkeeper out and he had to go for it.
He had his eyes on the ball, but he had his eyes on the keeper as well. It wasn't like he was trying to take it first time. The ball was bouncing, he saw the keeper coming, and he tries to go for it, thinks it's a 50-50, cleans the keeper out. There's no debate.
No, there's not. Absolutely, you are right. If that comes over his shoulder and he's trying to bring it down, yeah, that's a different talking point, but it's not. He's going for the ball. Keeper's the last man. If he connects with any part of the goalkeeper, and the goalkeepers are endangered species protected by the Referees Wildlife Association. So as soon as he touches the goalkeeper, he's pretty much already made the ref's mind up for him. And there was no need to do it. It was so early in the game. I think City had a pretty strong foothold in the game anyway. Were they 1-0 down at the time? But I mean, the way they imploded after that Liverpool, is the most concerning thing of all. They didn't have a compact shape. That their familiar failings of dealing with balls into the area reared its very ugly head again, and City tore them apart. But, you know, Liverpool's... We've all lauded their attack over the first three games of the season, rightly so, but there's always been that nagging sense that their defence is going to let them down, and it did in a massive way.
Well, if there's one team that are going to go down to 10 men away to Manchester City... You know, Liverpool wouldn't be one of the teams that you would think could shut up shop because they just don't have the personnel to do that. And it comes back to, I know we hark back to it, but we mentioned in the summer in the transfer window, they were linked with a defensive midfielder who was Keita, really, or a box-to-box midfielder, someone who would give them more bite anyway. That's not happening until next year. And then the big one for them was Virgil van Dijk. He was their number one target at the start of the summer. They didn't get him, and so they just moved on then to Salah and Keita. So where was the thinking behind that? Because they knew Klopp understood and identified that they had a problem in defence, central defence, and they didn't rectify that. So I thought they brought it on themselves. But I would say up until the 37th minute, was it, that Mane got sent off, I thought Liverpool looked a real threat, as they will do against a lot of teams this season because of the pace and the power they've got up front.
You feel that it's going to go like that for a lot of the season with Liverpool, that it'll seesaw where they'll blow teams away and everyone will be lauding how incredible they are. And then when those games where they do fold like a deck of cards and everyone will complain about their lack of recruitment in defensive areas, it feels like it's going to kind of swing that way all season with Liverpool, and then they'll kind of end up where they deserve to end up, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Liverpool begin games incredibly fast, breakneck speed, and they more often than not get a goal ahead. But I mean, even if you go back to the Watford game, Watford exposed the exact same problems. Balls into the box, a keeper who has improved massively, there's no denying that, but still doesn't inspire his centre-backs with enough confidence to come and claim them balls. And, you know, if a lot of Liverpool defenders consider Joel Matip their best defender ahead of Dejan Lovren, Joel Matip didn't have any influence on that game, didn't rally the troops, didn't bring them together and direct his team to, like I said, be a little bit more compact, you know, force City to do something different. No one in the Liverpool team looked to influence that game after Mane sending off.
I was going to say as well that if they're going to have to outscore a lot of opponents this season, I thought that Salah's going to have to improve his finishing, because against Watford he missed quite a few chances. Against Hoffenheim, I think, in the Champions League, he missed a few as well. He gets himself into positions because of his pace and his incision, his incisive play, but I just think that once he gets there, he doesn't look like someone you would back scoring all the time, and it's imperative the way Liverpool play, because they don't have an out-and-out striker. They've got Firmino up there, so they need their wingers, Mane, who does it, and Salah, who needs to do it, to chip in and get the goals as well.
There was no messing from Man City, though, was there? I mean, they were given the opportunities. They tore them to shreds. And I mean, Kevin De Bruyne, one of the best players in the league, probably his best game so far this season. I mean, they were ruthless.
Well, Guardiola said after the game, didn't he? So we're a very lucky club to have Kevin in our team. And he was. He was superb. He just pulled the strings. You could see him going over and telling someone as experienced as David Silva and as lethal as Sergio Aguero, leave it, lads, I've got this. I think it was after the third or fourth goal. You know, he was just pulling the strings. He was so influential. He's just got such great vision. He's so great on the ball. He brings that quality to an already star-studded lineup, admittedly, but he's a real difference maker. I think Guardiola would like to see him get on the score sheet a little bit more. But, you know, if they're going to have grand ambitions in the Champions League and winning the Premier League again, he's seminal to what they're going to do.
I think for him to get more goals, that he needs to play where he played against Liverpool at the weekend, because we had touched on it before. And I think the first three league matches, he played him in midfield, in central midfield, and let David Silva be a little bit more attacking and try and kind of pick the pass. And I think that you're taking away one of his main strengths, because De Bruyne can shoot very, very well on either foot. And as we've said loads of times before, the weight of his pass is amazing. The through ball, the vision that he has for that. So I think that Guardiola would need to play him in that position, one of the three in the line behind one striker, whether or not it's two strikers, if he plays Jesus and Aguero.
Magnificent player. Let's head to Goodison Park, gentlemen. It was an excellent result for Tottenham, 3-0 away at Everton. Another poor result for Everton following their abject performance against Chelsea. Harry Kane finally scored this season.
Of course,
rejoice.
It's no longer August.
what did you make of the game over there?
Well, I said on last week's podcast that I thought this was a really encouraging fixture for Spurs. First of all, playing away from Wembley after the disappointment of the Burnley draw. And I thought it was a good test for them against a team, again, that had ambitions of maybe usurping Tottenham or breaking in their glass ceiling of finishing in the top six. So I thought it was a real good measure of where Spurs are really at, because I personally don't think they deserve to lose against Chelsea and didn't deserve to win against Burnley. I thought they're creating so many chances. Obviously to go away to any away ground and win 3-0 is superb. But Spurs, you could easily be talking about Spurs in double figures from that game. Harry Kane, again, held his hand up. It was a cross, not a shot. But it doesn't matter. It's indicative of what Spurs are doing in games. They're creating attacking chances. And he got that little bit of luck he deserved. 100 goals in, three full seasons? It's magnificent. Spurs, and again, I've said it every week, that I've seen them play, if they play like they did against Chelsea, like they did against Burnley, they are going to blow a lot of teams out of the water, and that's exactly what they did against Everton.
I thought another plus for them was Davinson Sanchez, the kind of late signing anyway. It wasn't as late as some of them in the league, but he came in and he played him in front or in between Alderweireld and Vertonghen, and he just looked really assured.
Yeah.
Granted, he didn't have that much in the way of opposition, so it was quite a nice introduction to the Premier League, and you wouldn't expect to get that at Goodison. But I thought Kane, I was looking at it beforehand, he scored 100 career goals for Spurs in 169 games, and he's done that quicker than a lot of the players like Henry and Shearer did for their respective clubs. So it's very, very impressive. I think he's just someone who just gets the absolute maximum out of his ability, yeah. And that's through dedication and hard work, I would imagine. And it's very, very good to see, and it's promising for Spurs for the rest of the season.
And when you consider that he's played that role largely up front on his own, like the players you mentioned were mainly in a two, Henry certainly not towards the end of his career, but certainly at the beginning with Bergkamp. So it makes his achievement even more eye-catching, really. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and he's got a fantastic supply line. We mentioned Kevin De Bruyne. Christian Eriksen has got to be on a par with him at the moment. Yeah, he's such a massive influence on that team. He's one of the most underrated players in the Premier League, if not Europe, for me.
Last season, you didn't think that he was perhaps worth the kind of credentials that kind of came his well. Yeah. Yeah. You thought, I mean, towards the end of the season...
Well, you've got a long memory.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But I remember we discussed it last season, you thought that perhaps he wasn't quite in that bracket, but you've come round.
Thanks for that. I just thought he took a while to catch fire. Now, if you look at his stats from last season, they obviously blow my argument out of the water, but I never really got the sense that he caught fire at all last season, whereas... this season, that is certainly not the case. You know, he's interchanged with Kane and Dele Alli, popping up all over the pitch. He's again, we're talking about playmakers on the ball in De Bruyne. Eriksen is certainly up there. He can deliver the pinpoint passes that Harry Kane needs to pick out the late runs of Dele Alli into the box. He's such an asset. He's such a weapon for Spurs at the moment.
I honestly think that he's Spurs' best player, or most important player, I would say. And I think that'll really come to the fore in the Champions League.
Now, for all of Everton's recruitment, there was a lot of noise about that this summer. It's been a couple of poor results for them, mainly in terms of performance-wise, rather more than the results. Now, Koeman bemoaned his club's inability to sign a replacement for Lukaku. It seems evident that they clearly need a top centre forward. There's a real kind of lack of balance to that team at the moment. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we were all kind of impressed, certainly by Wayne Rooney's first two games of the season. He scored against Stoke and City, and maybe we thought, okay, maybe he can revive glories of old as a central striker. But no, we've touched on it in last week's Transfer Deadline podcast. That was one flaw we could see in their recruitment process. And they have recruited a lot of quality in goal in Pickford. I think Michael Keane's going to be a very, very important defender for both club and country going forward. But yeah, as well as the issue up top, there just seems to be a real lack of width, unnecessarily so. They've got some really good options that don't seem to get a look in under Koeman in Kevin Morales and Aaron Lennon. It just seems a bit baffling that they're not being bought in even as a plan B option on the bench.
I thought there was some nice interplay between Rooney and Ramirez and maybe Sigurdsson a few times, but it didn't really get them anywhere. You know, it looked good, but there was no end product. And I think that comes back to the fact that they haven't replaced Lukaku. And that's something, they knew Lukaku was leaving in February. So they've had a long time to plan for this. And the fact that they've been left with Sandro within three very like-minded number 10s behind him with Barkley to come back maybe as well. I know that he'll most likely move on, but it, as you said, it just lacks balance.
They got Calvert-Lewin as well. He looks a decent player, but I mean, you can't expect a 20-year-old to lead the line for a Premier League team trying to push a top six, can you? I mean, you want players like that into, as you said, impact off the bench, things like that. You can't expect someone like that to lead a line.
Yeah, but I mean, we all identified it. You need a proven Premier League goal scorer, and you know, like any player, moving to a foreign country, a foreign league, they need time to adapt. Now, Sandro may go on to be a very good player, but Calvert-Lewin, like you said, it's unfair on them to expect them to pick up the mantle of a 25-goal-a-season striker in Lukaku. But yeah, it, you know, and everyone lauded Sigurdsson, but like you say, all of a sudden it looks very samey in there amongst them three players. So I wouldn't be surprised to see quite a few changes for Everton in the weeks ahead.
I'd like to head over to Swansea now, chaps. Renato Sanchez had his debut on Sunday night. They lost 1-0 at home to Newcastle. There was a lot of intrigue around his debut. He's very off the pace, isn't he? I mean, he's only 20, yeah. Is he 19 or 20 years old? 20 years old. You could kind of feel that the crowd were G-ing him on. His team were trying to G him on in terms of giving him the ball as much as possible. It just wasn't happening for him yesterday, whether it was just a bad game, whether he's extremely rusty. What were your kind of initial thoughts from his first kind of Premier League outing?
I think all of that. He did look extremely rusty, and you know, he's got cause for doing so. But I just thought that you could tell that everybody, you know, the cameras were trained on him right from the start. Yeah. When he was very much this superstar signing, because it isn't a signing that you, as we touched on last week, that you'd have expected Swansea to make. I know there's the Clement link to Bayern there, but he just looked, it looked as if he was trying too hard and everybody else was trying too hard for him as well. And you know that once he gets used to his teammates and the Premier League, that he should grow into the player that we all think he will be. But it wasn't a very, very good debut. And you would just think maybe you would take him out of the firing line a little bit for the next few matches, maybe introduce him slowly and just help him, because he's had such a setback at Bayern where he didn't play at all. And huge things were expected of him, so I think maybe just ease him in gently.
But I mean, like you say, the cameras were trained on him and all eyes were trained on him. His first four touches on the ball, he got dispossessed straight away. And he was certainly not the only Swansea player guilty of that. Tom Carroll, who I think is a very tidy player on the ball, was just as guilty of being A, caught in possession, and B, giving it away sloppily. And Newcastle, you know, credit to them, they were well worth the win, actually. Swansea, that's as poor a Swansea have played since Bob Bradley was in charge, probably.
Oh, you think so? I thought Swansea looked semi-decent yesterday.
No, I
thought they created plenty of chances. I thought it could have gone either way.
I tell you what, I thought Jordan Ayew was decent on the ball. Liked a lot of his control, but other than that, no, I don't think they offered any punch at all.
Yeah, sorry, Johnny. I thought they looked really flat as well. And I think Clement said as much.
Leicester City, Chelsea is the next game we'll discuss. Another goal for Alvaro Morata, or more specifically, another headed goal for Alvaro Morata. 2-1 winners. Chelsea went 2-0 up and looked very comfortable. And then it was very, very nervy towards the end when Vardy pulled back the penalty. But they're looking much better now than they did. It seems that shocker from the opening day defeat to Burnley seems to be well behind them now, doesn't it?
Yeah, we were discussing this the other day, weren't we? The thing about Morata, I don't think I quite grasped just how good he is. In terms of his aerial ability, he's almost got that kind of Les Ferdinand leap hanging in the air. And you wouldn't say he kills centre-backs with his movement. He stands where you would expect a centre-forward would stand, right in the centre of a goal, waiting for a pinpoint delivery. And he's got a great supply line behind him to do that. And his leap for his headed goal was superb. You know me, I love headed goals and free kicks. And it was just magnificent. You know, he was bought in, you sensed, with Chelsea going in a different direction. He's not the barreling, difficult to contain striker that Costa was. He was going to be bought in to get on the end of chances, and that's what he's doing. You know, he's up there to be the focal point, the totem of that attack, and he's putting chances away every week now.
And it's helped how quickly he settled, I think, because he was the one bright spark in that opening day defeat, the dismal defeat to Burnley. So I think it's helped that he settled straight away and there hasn't been any real questions about what he can bring to the team.
That link up, even with Aspilicueta now technically as a right-sided centre-back, seems to be something that is working nicely. He kind of is finding space on the edge of the area. We all know his crossing ability, and that's clearly why Zappa Costa was brought in. I think he has one of the highest converting or highest crossing success rates in Italy last season. If you can just find Morata's head, it's half your job done then, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and if there was, again, Victor Moses was one of the most improved players of last season. If there was one criticism you could aim at him, it's that he doesn't necessarily possess that ability to pick out his central striker. But yeah, Morata is, and he's link-up player as well. You know, I'm talking about him as a poacher, as a finisher. He's link-up player as well. He's not doing very much wrong. Balls are coming into him, they're sticking, he's doing some great layoffs. And Chelsea, again, yeah, you're right. It looked a little bit fraught after Leicester scored their goal. And I think Chelsea do have that look about them. You know, no doubt they were the best team in the Premier League last season. That's why they won it. But you do sense there is maybe a little bit of nervousness or not that assuredness in the Chelsea team that was there last season when the games are so close now.
I think they knew back then as well that they could just give the ball to Hazard and he could do something, take a bit of pressure off the rest of the team. So I think once Hazard gets back into the swing of things and he's being gradually worked back in as well, I think Chelsea will be back looking.
It'd be great to see them together, wouldn't it? Hazard and Morata.
And again, you could even just tell that against Leicester after he came on, things started to calm down a bit. Mm-hmm. You knew you could give him the ball, that he was either going to draw a foul and just kind of slow the pace down for the last 10, 12 minutes or so. And yeah, that was already clear just for his brief cameo at Leicester. Yeah.
And you've got Kante scoring absolute screamers.
If he's adding that to his game, there's no hope for any midfield in
England. I don't know how that got in, though. That was a strange one.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
But and you see Antonio Conte saying that he can only get better. You know, that's, yeah, goodbye the rest of the league then, I think. Superb play.
What about elsewhere in the Premier League? Gentlemen, before we look forward, Arsenal got a very kind of important win. I mean, it sounds crazy that you'd expect them to beat Bournemouth 3-0, but considering everything leading up to it, that's very much what Arsene Wenger and his team needed.
Arsenal fan TV must have been very quiet this week. A solid 3-0 win. What's to talk about after that?
Well, they had to bring a rap star on just to boost ratings, didn't they, this week, because there's no one complaining.
But, it was. And I think we had contrasting views last week, didn't you? You thought it was a very nice fixture for Arsenal when I actually thought it was a nice fixture for Bournemouth. But no, in fairness, it turned into a fairly routine win. Lacazette, the more I see of him in terms of his striking ability with the ball, he doesn't do too much outside of the box. But if you give him a sight of goal, he'll bury it. I've been very impressed with his finishing so far. And, you know, it was, you know, there's no qualms about it. It was a game that Arsenal had to win, and they did very easily in the end. Bournemouth, we obviously discussed Frank de Boer's second. I don't think Eddie Howe is anywhere near that league. He's proven that he deserves time to get it right. But I've seen nothing from Bournemouth so far in the four games to suggest that the way they're heading is going to get them out of trouble. I think Eddie Howe needs maybe a little bit of a different approach. Again, I think you touched on it last week, Colts. There's maybe not enough players in that team that do the dirty work, roll their sleeves up and get stuck in. Really, that's what the situation calls for.
Yeah, I think Eddie Howe said that after the match, that out of the four games that they played, only the Man City game was where they've played to how he would like them to play. And not just in terms of their nice passing football, but in terms of actually getting stuck in and showing a bit of grit and gumption. So I think that it's going to be a difficult season for Bournemouth. I thought that maybe at the start of the season, but I didn't because of their fixture list at the start of the campaign. But I just think they've put a lot of money and a lot of faith in Jermaine Defoe.
Yeah.
And you just think, he was fantastic last year up until January, was it, for Sunderland? Then wasn't that great after. And he hasn't really done anything yet, and he looked completely lost against Arsenal. So I think that there's serious kind of question marks about what they need to do and what they can do to turn it around.
It's good news for Brighton this weekend, though. They finally got off the mark, and they got off the mark well. 3-1 winners at home to West Brom.
Yeah, against an obdurate Tony Pulis side. That's a fantastic result. Again, you know, I don't think there was any question of the same kind of pressure being applied to Chris Hughton as the likes of De Boer. But yeah, they came out swinging, really. There was a massive touch of fortune about the first goal. But after that, they looked a really good team, really tidy on the ball. You know, they create plenty of options. They look a very good team going forward when the wind is in their sails. I guess the idea for opposition teams is to not let them build up a head of steam, because they look really impressive once they got that first goal.
Yeah, and I think are they away to Bournemouth on Friday night? So for Bournemouth, that's, even at this early stage of the season, that's a crucial match already.
Yeah. And for teams who probably don't know that kind of rivalry, Brighton-Bournemouth is a massive, massive rivalry. Not to be, understated in any way to a North London derby, Merseyside derby or Manchester derby. There's a lot of hatred between them two teams. So, yeah, that would be very tasty. Eddie Howe's really got his work cut out in that match.
Manchester United's perfect run came to an end at Stoke City. They were kind of talking before the game, like, how can Stoke stop the kind of United juggernaut? But I mean, they kind of held their own admirably. To be honest, it was a two-all draw was about right, wasn't it?
Just did what Stoke do. You know, they get the big teams up there, and they know how to play against them. I think Mark Hughes has got a pretty good record against Jose Mourinho, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Maybe that explains the handshake or non-handshake at the end of it, which is a bit petty. But
Mark Hughes does that with so many. Did he get a handshake from Wenger after the...
I'm not sure.
No.
Probably not. Wenger doesn't hand out many handshakes if he doesn't get the result he wants. Stoke did, what they usually do. I think for them, getting United up there, I think they almost treat that as a derby, don't they? It's one of, you know, it's as close as they get, I think, as a derby in the Premier League, if I'm right. So I think it's getting... not only a team that they view that way, but one of the biggest teams in the league and the team that's probably started the best in the league. So they had the bit between their teeth. And I don't know, I think United, if you really look at it, it's what, 10 points from four games? Do you know, if they were going to have that after the first four matches, I think they would take that.
I've been really impressed with what I've seen of Stoke this season. I thought they were more than worth their win against Arsenal. And I think, like you say, they acquitted themselves really well against United. Again, I've been really disappointed with the defending I've seen this season, and the corner for Marcus Rashford's header, and Choupo-Moting, sorry, I'm always forgetting names now, again, being left unmarked at the back post as well. I mean, this is, you know, schoolboy. Well, it's insulting to schoolboys to say that, really, but this is standard. You know, no teams have defenders on the post anymore from corners. There's this obsession with zonal marking, which can be done right if you set your team up the right way. A lot of teams don't do that either. And yeah, I actually think Stoke were well worth their point. Probably could have even nicked it, really.
Before we go on to look at the Champions League this week, gentlemen, I remembered our pop quiz this week.
Fantastic.
Okay, are you ready? Yeah, get the brains working. Oh. Chris Wood is just the second player from Oceania to score in their first Premier League start. Who was the first and when?
Oceania.
Yeah.
Okay, so who we got? Ryan Nelson.
Have a think about that, and we'll discuss.
Okay. All right.
Discuss the Champions League. So the Champions League is back this week. Group stages, rather. Of course, we've had some qualifying stuff, but no one really cares about any of that, do they? There's a really big tie happening on Tuesday night. Barcelona take on Juventus. I mean, for all the supposed crises at Barcelona, they're going pretty well on the pitch.
Yeah, I watched them against Espanyol at the weekend there, and they were fantastic. Messi especially, and I know that's nothing new, but yeah, it's not going out on a limb. But he seems to maybe have taken the criticism and used that as a kind of catalyst to kind of improve even more or continue at the same level that he was in seasons before, because he looks as if he's kind of dragged that team to where they need to be through the first few matches and through the Neymar debacle and everything else that's gone on, Coutinho and whoever else they did or didn't get. But I thought they just looked really, really impressive, and the fact that they had Dembele to come on for the last, I think it was 20 minutes or something like that, maybe not even that, and he showed in little glimpses what he's going to bring to the team as well. And he already seems to have a little bit of an understanding with Messi, because they're obviously high caliber players. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom as what I thought it was going to be at the start of the season for Barca.
Another player who really stood out for me, Ivan Rakitic, mm-hmm. in that game. He's linking up with Messi was again superb. He again, you know, we're waxing lyrical about influential midfielders, and I think he's right up there. He helps make that team tick. Obviously, Messi is still the main man. Obviously, it's a massive bonus having Luis Suarez back as well on the score sheet. But yeah, Rakitic is you know, so important to the protection and the production of that Barcelona team.
Over in Italy, though, everyone was saying that the Juve's rivals might close them down this season, but the way things have gone so far, 3 games, 3 wins, 10 goals scored. I mean, they're not exactly slowing down either, are they?
And their rivals, Milan, were smashed by Lazio, weren't they? Yeah. Even with Leo Bonucci. But yeah, no, I mean, and you know, we're talking about some of Europe's most potent strike forces. You can't do that without mentioning Dybala and Gonzalo Higuain. They're formidable, absolutely formidable. And don't forget, they knocked Barcelona out of the Champions League last season en route to the final. What a cracking match to open the group stages of this season's competition.
That's definitely the game to be watching out for on Tuesday. I mean, even if your team are playing, I think I'd probably be watching that game. On Wednesday, chaps, Liverpool-Sevilla is a game to look out for, I think, isn't it? Rematch of the Europa League final from a couple of years ago. But probably Dortmund's trip to Tottenham, particularly it being at Wembley Stadium, I think that's a game that a lot of people will be tuning in for. Some people, perhaps from behind the sofa, if you're a Tottenham fan. What do you reckon?
Well, if it was at Dortmund, I think Tottenham fans might be a little bit more confident. It's a massive ask for Tottenham, and it's everything between now and then is going to be about the Wembley hoodoo, and that piles more pressure on Pochettino, more pressure on the team. But they need to be able to handle it, and they need to show that they can deal with playing at Wembley. But I still think that if they play to reference what Steve-O said earlier, if they play to the level that they played certainly on Saturday and maybe against Chelsea earlier on in the season, I think they'll be all right. And Dortmund will enjoy coming to Wembley, but Spurs have to make it difficult for them.
I think most teams will enjoy coming to Wembley, don't they? And, you know, I think Spurs, in both games really, I think, you know, recent encounters between both teams, Liverpool and Sevilla, Tottenham, Dortmund, are very fresh in the minds. The last time Spurs played Dortmund was it two seasons ago, and Dortmund over 180 minutes, like Monaco did to them last season. No team tore Spurs apart like Dortmund did. Every pass was a backwards pass towards Hugo Lloris, and obviously Sevilla beat Liverpool in the Europa League final, which was a cracking final. But yeah, so it's definitely two games that English fans will be interested in, and as Colt says, Spurs have got to get over this Wembley hoodoo. They've got to get a win on the board, and I do actually think once they get there, that then this talk will quickly go away, and doing that against the Dortmund team in the Champions League would be a pretty decent place to start doing it.
Easier said than done.
Well, yeah, true.
Definitely looking forward to that. Okay, gentlemen, before we wrap up this week, have you got me an answer for our pop quiz this week?
Are we not out of time?
So Chris Wood is just the second player from Oceania to score in their first Premier League start. Who was the first player and when?
I don't know when. Have you got an answer? I'm going to go Ryan Nelson, Blackburn.
You're really close.
Blackburn? Oh, no. Is it Blackburn?
I know. Oh, if it's Blackburn, I know who it is. Well, I think I know who it is.
Blackburn, Oceania. God.
Surely he's out of time. Yeah. Have another pop.
Oh, Emerton.
Yes.
Brett Emerton.
Well done. Brett Emerton. Any quick punt at the year?
Oh, when I was a wee lad.
Exactly. 2003. Well done. Well, that's all we've got time for this week, chaps. Thanks very much for stopping by.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, guys.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. You can subscribe to Extra Time on iTunes and find us on the website at thenational.ae. Thanks for listening.